You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and
conditions. 18 plus. I read a lot of old manuscripts while researching the show. Oftentimes, the writing is stuffy and dull. Sometimes, it's beautiful prose. And other times, you just find those passages that you fall in love with. Now, most of these old manuscripts, especially those about piracy, tend to be written by educated commoners who then shop them around to the local gentry. What they're doing there is looking for a patron, somebody to read their work, to pay to have it published, and then to take a stake in any profits that might come from it. Publishing houses were growing more and more common all across Europe, in this case in England, but they rarely took on the expense of printing unless the book was already a proven bestseller. And then they rarely paid royalties out. But I love the petitions for patronage that you find at the beginning of so many of these manuscripts. They've graced most of the primary sources that I've used for this show. Those by McSquimmelin and Dampier and Sharp and Ringrose, all of them had noble patrons. But I especially love the petition and the pamphlet, News from the Sea of Two Notorious Pirates, Ward the Englishman and Dansaker the Dutchman. It reads, quote, To the right worshipful and most worthy gent M. William Cockin, Sir, if the greatness of your worth can extend itself to the lowness of this discourse, or the dignity of your courtesy in accepting my love, prove a counterscale to my presumption and boldness, you shall engrave in men's minds the nobility of your humbleness, and fortify my endeavors to enheighten your name and memory. To be a patron, although but to a beggar, is the office of a king, and to be a protector of the meanest, I doubt not will well become the magistrate. End quote. I chose to read that because those seem like suitable words to thank our patrons from Patreon. It is only the dignity of their courtesy and the nobility of their humbleness that fortify my endeavors. Without all of our patrons, this show would not be possible, including our Commodore class. That's Commodores Scurvy Pete, Kane, Kenway, Hefe, Zuman, Nopales, Matthew the Navigator, Bull, Vertigon, Conifalinde, Rumgut, and Bootstraps Bailey. And of course, our Quartermaster Heather. To be a patron, although but to a beggar, is indeed the office of a king. Hello. Welcome to the Pirate History Podcast. My name is Matt. Thank you for listening. I hope everyone had a happy and fun Talk Like a Pirate Day. I heard a lot of great pirate accents and a few groan-worthy pirate jokes. For example, do you know why pirates don't take a shower before they walk the plank? Because they'll just wash up on shore later. I also heard a number of wonderful real-world pirate quotes. My favorite of these came thanks to John Thor Ewing via Twitter. He quoted Captain Bartholomew Roberts saying, quote, In an honest service there is thin commons, low wages, and hard labor. In this, plenty and satiety, pleasure and ease, liberty and power. No, a merry life and a short one shall be my motto. This is episode 87, That Perfidious Pirate. And that quote is actually a pretty great place to start today. Even though Black Bart wouldn't come around for another century, that quote encapsulates very nicely the attitudes of the pirates that concern us today. mostly Jack Ward. Jack Ward was one of many corsairs operating out of Barbary in the spring of 1606. He'd made a name for himself in Tunis, he'd earned the trust of Uthman Day, and he'd been nicely set up in the Fortress of the Treasury. That certainly does sound like the pleasure and ease of which Captain Roberts spoke, but a corsair's job is not to sit around counting money and hobnobbing with the wealthy. If he were to keep his status and what Black Bart Roberts would call his liberty and power, he would have to go out hunting. By the fall of 1606, Ward was in the eastern Mediterranean, probably closer to the Aegean or just off the coast of Cyprus, with many of his compatriots in tow. That included Richard Bishop and a sailor under-bishop named Anthony Johnson. Both were crew members that Ward had picked up in Salé, Morocco, just a few months earlier. Now, Bishop and Johnson were aboard a small pinnace, with Bishop in command. It only held about 17 men, but it was fast, and it was armed, and it had a shallow draft. Ward himself was in command of the Gift, a Dutch flyboat with 94 crewmen all told. 67 of those were European. There were mostly Englishmen, but there were Dutch and Spanish and Venetian sailors among them. But 28 crewmen were Janissary warriors sent along by Uthman Day. And really, they were mostly European as well. At least by birth, they were Armenian and Hungarian and Greek, but they had all been raised in Turkey. No, the Gift was well-armed, maybe 20 or 30 guns strong. That's more guns than anyone would expect on board a relatively small Dutch sailing vessel, including the crew of the English merchantman, the John Baptist. The John Baptist was on her way from Sicily to Greece, captained by a man named John Key, and she had a cargo of silks valued at about 500 pounds. In early November, around 8 p.m., John Key spotted the Gift headed in her direction. Now, it was a Dutch ship, so there wasn't really cause for alarm, but to Captain Key's credit, the John Baptist ran from the Gift. She made it to Greece, reaching the mainland coast of Peloponnesus in the southwest of Greece. And I wonder if John Key felt relieved here when he saw a pinnace round an outcrop and sail toward him. If he did, his relief was short-lived. The pinnace was commanded by Richard Bishop. There is a line in the play, A Christian Turned Turk, about John Ward, in which a sailor informs Ward that a ship is incoming. He says, quote, "It seems pursued by a man of war. They make with us for succor," end quote. And then another pirate, who could be Richard Bishop in this case, says, quote, "Yes, we'll succor her, and suck her too, as dry as a usurer's palm," end quote. I like that little play on words. But what he's saying here is that a larger ship was chasing after the prey, and then another ship that seemed to be friendly pretended to give them aid. That's what Bishop attempted to do here, and then he intended to suck her as dry as a usurer's palm. He opened fire on the John Baptist. Now, such a small vessel was no match for even a merchantman like the John Baptist, at least without the element of stealth and surprise, but it would keep the John Baptist occupied while Jack Ward could catch up and come in behind on the Gift. Ward captured the John Baptist on that night in November 1606. They loaded all of the silk up in that pinnace, which had a skeleton crew, and sailed back to Tunis. Richard Bishop, though, stayed behind, and then John Key and the crew of the John Baptist were captured and given a choice. See, Jack Ward was going to keep the John Baptist and the Gift. To be fair, they were both nice ships, and he really wanted them. So he could drop off these nice men here in Greece. They could maybe make it to a friendly harbor and maybe make it home. Or they could join up with him. He did have two ships, after all, and he did need the men. He gave them a speech not unlike that of Black Bart Roberts. In honest service, there is thin commons, low wages, and hard labor. In this, plenty, pleasure, and ease. That same play, A Christian Turned Turk, has a line for this as well. Quote, No, we have other use for you. Have not enticed you hither for your gold. It is the man we want. Is it not a shame men of your qualities and personage should live as cankers, eating up the soil that gave you being?" End quote. The fictitious sailors in the play reply, eventually, after what feels like ages of what Ward calls virtuous lectures. They whinge on about widows and orphans and morality, but finally say, quote, "We must obey necessity, since 'tis our fates to be surprised thus by this monster beast. We must lick the fierce lion's feet till happier times do give us freedom in his punished crimes." End quote. Now, of course, this play was written after the fact, so the author was free to give his characters noble license in what they wound up doing in reality. In this case, the real sailors of the John Baptist licked the lion's feet by joining up with Jack Ward. A few years later, John Key and another sailor named Jeffrey Wiseman found themselves before the Admiralty Court. They both originally came from the John Baptist before serving under Jack Ward, and they would argue to the Admiralty Court that they didn't have a choice here. They had to wait until happier times gave them freedom, presumably when Ward was punished for his crimes. Now, Ward had not been captured nor punished when these two pirates, John Key and Jeffrey Wiseman, stood before the court. Ward, that is, was still a free man. Due to some extenuating circumstances, which we'll talk about later, I actually kind of believe some of these pirates really were reluctant, at least John Key. They were just, at best, riding the tides of fate. Now, the crew of the John Baptist were split up. John Key, the captain, and the top five officers were brought aboard Gift. They would be the most troublesome, potentially, and the most likely to try some form of daring heroics to save their vessel. Ward wanted them kept under close watch. But the other 11 crewmen from the John Baptist were left on board their ship. They knew the workings of the John Baptist, and Ward sent over 13 men to keep an eye on them. It was a touchy situation here. Taking on a number of crewmen was always difficult. During the height of the Golden Age, years later, new recruits that came from a captured vessel weren't allowed to sign their name to the code or to carry arms until they had proven themselves. They might not be trustworthy. The author George Bach writes in his book Barbary Pirate, quote, "John Key claims that he was given no choice but to sail with the captain. This does not square with what we know of Ward's methods of recruitment, which at all times relied more on the enticements of wealth rather than threats or compulsion. When a ship surrendered without fighting, as the John Baptist had, Ward demonstrated time and again a willingness to release in one of the ship's boats those who did not want to enter his service." End quote. Now, the crew of the John Baptist, the 11 remaining crew members, were given the hardest, dirtiest, and most unpleasant duties. They were expected to fulfill them properly, quickly, and without question, all the while under close observation. At least two or three of those were janissaries, who would not hesitate to open their throats or run them through should they attempt a mutiny. But this wasn't just about making sure they were trustworthy. There was something else here. It was sort of a test to make sure that when it needed to happen, they could get the job done, to make sure that they were worthy seamen. And then there was also an element of finding out what they were best at, what they excelled at. Would they make good carpenters or gunners or maybe a cook? The John Baptist, the crew there, had a leader among them. Not Captain Key, but just a common sailor. A man that they chose to lead and represent them. And his name was Abraham Crofton, and he would rise in fairly short order to be one of Jack Ward's top lieutenants. Ward sailed away on board the Gift with the John Baptist in tow, but it wasn't the John Baptist anymore. Once the crews and the supplies were all in their proper place and settled in, John Ward gave her a new name. She was named after an English romantic hero, the leader of the Merry Men, a band of noble thieves robbing from the rich and giving to the poor there in Sherwood Forest. No, not that one. Jack Ward named this ship Little John. This is a spectacular name for so many reasons. First, his name was John. The ship's name was the John Baptist. Now, she was still named John, but after a John that far better represented what John Ward meant to represent. That is, that's bold. And it suggests to us that Ward saw what they were doing as a sort of Robin Hood tale. They were thieves and criminals and outlaws in the eyes of the law, but they weren't wrong to be doing those things. They were fighting an unjust system. They were circumventing the law to do what was right, even if it was illegal, at least in his eyes. The vast majority of the English people would come to see things differently. John Ward was a traitor and a pirate, no Robin Hood at all, but some would see him to be what he claimed, and he would become a beacon for others to come and join him. The name was a sort of propaganda. I don't know that it was intended to be a sort of propaganda, but it worked like it. Are you an Englishman? Do you hate the vile tyranny of King James? Do you hate what he has done to sully the name of our good Queen Bess? Then, in that case, this name suggests, you need to fight, like Robin Hood and Maid Marian and Friar Tuck and Little John. You need to stand up and fight the oppression of the Pretender King and, you know, the Sheriff of Nottingham, or in this case, the Scottish Catholic sympathizer who sat on the throne. It was intended to send a message by John Ward, probably to the people who would hear about this piracy, but more importantly, at least immediately to John Ward, it would send a message to the mariners that had just joined up with him. They were all English, and he was telling them that what he was doing here in the Mediterranean was like what Robin Hood did in Sherwood Forest. It was a just cause, and now they were part of it. They were part of the modern-day Merry Men, robbing from the rich, which would have been a code for Catholic people in their eyes, and giving to the poor. Now, in this case, they themselves were the poor, along with their allies, not exactly the widows and orphans of England, but once again, that quote from Black Bart Roberts rings true. A merry life and a short one shall be my motto. A week later, or maybe a little more, the Venetian galley Ruby mysteriously went missing. Nobody knew what had happened, but they suspected piracy, and it got a few tongues wagging, mostly in Venice and Tuscany and Sicily. Nothing serious, no fleets were raised, no retaliatory actions were to take place, but they were paying attention, and they were preparing agents to sail for Barbary to investigate. Now, those agents would find out that it was, in fact, Jack Ward that stole the ruby, but by that point, he was already much more famous for a much bigger theft. Around the 1st of January 1607, another Venetian ship, the Carminati, was captured by pirates. Her holds were emptied of all her cargo, at least everything worth stealing, but they left the food and the tackle in place. Now this wasn't Jack Ward this time. It would later be laid at his feet, claiming that Jack Ward was the mastermind behind the whole operation, but this one wasn't him. These pirates let the Carminati go on her way. But as Adrian Tenniswood puts it in Pirates of Barbary, quote, good fortune didn't sail with her, end quote. On 28 January, Jack Ward did intercept Carminati. The previous pirates didn't have that many men. They didn't have that many guns either. They really only had enough to capture the ship, but not enough to sail her away. Jack Ward, though, did have men and guns, and he wanted this ship as well. So he took her. The crew was put on board a ship's boat, likely the pinnace from earlier that had sailed to Tunis and back, and Jack Ward had a brand new ship. You see, a month and a half had passed since the John Baptist had been taken. When that pinnace went and dropped off the silk, they would have picked up men. They would have crammed that little boat to the rafters. Then they would have come back to meet up with Jack Ward, assuming that some of the John Baptist crew had been unwilling to join up. They would have had enough sailors to sail both ships, but now that all of the John Baptist's crew seemed ready to sail, they had enough to sail three ships, if slightly undermanned. Now, around this time, another ship was captured. This one wasn't captured by Jack Ward, but it was one of his lieutenants. He was actually the mastermind behind this one. That lieutenant was a man named Bill Graves, or William Graves. He captured a small English merchantman called the York Bonaventure, which was captained by a man named Andrew Barker. Now, generally, this was an unremarkable prize, except for the captain, Andrew Barker. See, he would go on to write a true and certain report of the beginning, proceedings, overthrows, and now present estate of Captain Ward and Dansaker, the two late famous pirates, from their first setting forth to this present time. That's the entire name of it. So we finally get a first-hand account beginning now, which I'm deeply excited for. We've been working off second- or third-hand accounts at best for some time now. But at this point, Ward had four decent ships. He had the Gift, the Little John, Ruby, and the Carminati. They had enough pirates to sail them, but they were lightly crewed, not enough to fill them up. So Jack Ward and Richard Bishop and Anthony Johnson and all roughly 100 or so crew members sailed for Tunis and the fortress at La Goleta. While there, they outfitted their ships to be fully capable warships. Uthman Day was pleased with all of the cargo that Ward brought in, so he further invested in Jack Ward. He gave him guns and powder and shot and good steel. But for a month or so, while the ships were being prepared, the men had the run of Tunis. They had purses full of coin, and they were given ample opportunities to spend it. And then they had a fearsome reputation. I think it's got to be a really heady feeling, being part of a group of violent, semi-famous criminals that have the backing of the ruling class. I mean, what would it have felt like to be one of Capone's capos in New York, walking into a bar? I mean, imagine the treatment that these pirates received at the local dives there in Tunis. There would have been good wine there. Despite it being a Muslim city, it was close to Italy, and it was populated by a significant number of non-Muslims, and the Janissaries who were in charge, well, they even drank wine from time to time. But wine is the least of it. There would have been a number of other mind-altering substances there as well. There was coffee and tobacco and plenty of it, if that was your thing. But then there were the drugs that North Africa is somewhat famous for. Morocco is famous today for hashish, but in 1600 the entire Maghreb was well known for it. Mostly it was produced in Egypt and Turkey, but they produced a lot of it, and Algiers, Tripoli, and Tunis consumed more than their fair share. And then there was the narcotic called cat, spelled K-H-A-T, or perhaps cot. Today that's well known because of pirates, actually. Modern African pirates, nearly all of whom are Muslim, chew it almost daily, some of them more than almost. There were cot cults in Egypt and Morocco and all across Barbary, and they were willing to share, even with Europeans, even with Christians, as long as they could pay. And then there is the drug for which North Africa is perhaps best known, partly because of the beat writers like William Burroughs. That would be opium. Opium dens could be found in every dark alleyway in Tunis, at least in, you know, the dingier parts of town. You could drink it in a tea, or you could eat it, or you could smoke it, whatever your pleasure was. And you could hire company. You could hire men or women, whatever you chose. No one judged your taste there in the dens as long as you could pay. Which, well, perhaps a conversation needs to be had about the sexuality of John Ward and his men, but I think it's a fool's errand. An attempt to do so is difficult because there's very little hard evidence. We know that John Ward had a wife back in England, but that he rarely, if ever, saw her after leaving for the Maghreb. Many people have questioned his sexuality, but most of those were fire and brimstone preachers proselytizing about the sin and vice of these pirates in the North African coast, so it can't exactly be taken seriously. But North Africa has always had a reputation for vice and excessive sexuality. You could always find willing women or men to suit your needs as long as you had the money. It still had that feminine, erotic, luscious den of sin image from time immemorial, from Carthaginian days. Add in the hash and the cot and the wine and the opium and, well, you can see why coffee bars were so prevalent. You would likely need one. Of course, all of these things were haram. They were forbidden in Islamic culture. But these pirates weren't Muslim, at least not yet, and North Africa had a relaxed opinion about these things anyway. In 1631, a few years down the line, the Sultan would outlaw nearly all of these substances, except opium, oddly, but the Maghreb would completely ignore him and continue to use them as much as possible. Now, we're going to have to talk a lot more about pirates and drugs at some point in the future, but for now, Tunis was more than happy to drain the pirates' purses in any way possible. And it wasn't just the crew. Ward wasn't immune to these temptations either. News from the Sea, that pamphlet published just a few years later, tells us, quote, "At this time, Ward made his continuance and abode in Tunis. He spent his time in his accustomed riotous and lascivious manner. His licentious liberty so overmastered his reason and conquered the good that should remain in the mind and inclination of a Christian that the strength and power of all virtuous or good thoughts were taken from him. He was diverted and abased to the most vile actions, clothing his mind with the most ugly habiliments that either pride, luxury, or cruelty can produce from the blindness of unruly desires." End quote. In a true and certain report of Captain Ward, Andrew Barker, who was one of his prisoners slash crew members at this point, compared the actions of Ward and his men on shore to those at sea, and said they were, quote, "far more detestable and uncomely to be talked of, by Christianity to be condemned and abhorred. Their thieving, swearing, drinking, dicing are the least of their vices. Unlawfully are their goods got, and more ungodly are they consumed," end quote. In light of the English censorship there, Barker chose to, quote, "leave their sodomy and the rest of their crying sins, which I fear their atheism has led them into, to the judgment of the just revenger, and not give them to be talked of further by my pen." End quote. But while the pirates enjoyed themselves thoroughly, bad things were brewing on the horizon. People in Italy had begun to take real notice. They were talking about piracy in the halls of power everywhere from Genoa to Sicily to Rome to Venice. There do seem to be a lot of ships going missing, don't there? Well, you know Barbary and their barbarian corsairs. Ships are always going missing. They are large ships, though. Wealthy merchantmen with guns and sailors to defend them. I hear it's all to blame on one Englishman. They call him Sparrow. Now, Jack Ward was growing into something of a boogeyman, sort of a shadowy figure there in Italy. No one knew very much about him, but his actions were raising eyebrows. The Duke of Tuscany and the Venetians both had agents in Barbary. They had them in Tunis and in Algiers and Tripoli. They didn't know where Ward came from, but they were there to learn as much as they could, and they would eventually bring back word of Jack Ward and inform the English about this pirate. For now, though, in his homeland, Jack Ward was virtually unknown, beyond that blip on the Navy's radar for jumping ship and possibly stealing an empty vessel. But all that was going to change very shortly. Ward set out to sea again in early March 1607. His men were sated and satisfied, and once again poor. His ships were bristling with firepower and new recruits that wanted a bit of that leisurely excess that Ward's crew had just experienced.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere. This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon slash spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an eight-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
But something about the captain had changed. Perhaps all of that power and luxury and the intoxicants went to his head. News from the sea tells us, quote, "Ward had taken clean away the feeling of his wickedness. All his felicity was placed in the prosecuting of mischief. He neither feareth present death, nor feareth dangerous endurance or torments. So the bark of his did but ride at anchor, that is wasted in streams of spoil. Every peril undertaking in his unnatural actions seem pleasant to him, every reproach honorable, every doubt delightsome, yea, the very wounds that come by occasions of others' harms seem void of smart unto him. His life is nothing but a continual battle and defiance with Christians, with whom he ought to make his best peace. His senses are as so many swords that fight against him, his words so many blows, his deeds so many wounds." End quote. He was a different sort of pirate. He was a different sort of person than he had been. And he had big goals. And he had the tools with which to see those goals through. The gift was a 200-ton, 20-gun flyboat, but still the flagship of the fleet, captained by Admiral Jack Ward. There was the Ruby, of 400 tons, that was the Vice Admiral, commanded by Richard Bishop. Then there was Little John, 90 tons and 24 guns. That was probably captained by Anthony Johnson. And finally there was the Carminati, 800 tons and 30 guns. And that was probably captained by, well, they call him Master Grafton, but that was probably Abraham Crofton from the John Baptist. And we also know the names of a few other members of the crew. There was James Proctor of Southampton and John Frith of Plymouth. They were described as Ward's chief gunners. There was Joffrey Wiseman, and there was John Key from the John Baptist as well. And then there was William Graves, that lieutenant of Ward's. At the moment, he was serving as his first mate on board the Gift. In later pirate culture, he would be more accurately described as a quartermaster than a first mate. See, he defended the crew's interest against that of the captain. He may have served as, well, something of a template for later quartermasters to come. And Bill Graves is an interesting character. News from the sea tells us a bit about his character. It says, quote, "Graves was very inward with Ward, and one that among the rest might do most with him. Yet in their contentions and falling out at their feastings and bacchanals, would often revile Ward, calling him boar and oyster catcher, and upbraid him with the mean baseness of his beginning. Graves would often tell Ward that if it should one day be his fortune to kill him, as he thought it would, he doubted not but God would presently send an angel from heaven to carry him immediately thither for depriving the earth of such a vile creature." Now, at best, that comes down to us from a second or third-hand source. It probably derives from real statements made by the real William Graves later on in life, but whether or not there was any truth to them at the time, we'll never know. Personally, I think that those words were a bit of posturing in the part of the author to remind his readers and his patrons that Ward is not representative of the good Christian Englishman that he knew. It comes, in the account, on the heels of the crew under Ward bemoaning the violences done to the good people of, quote, France, Spain, Germany, Italy, Barbary, etc., end quote. But Ward convinced his crew to keep up those violences with his demonic talents for persuasion and a few of those mind-altering substances we spoke about earlier during one of his famous bacchanals. But we do have some verifiable words from William Graves in regard to the voyage on which they were setting out. He said, quote, "We were four well-manned and well-appointed ships over whom Captain Ward was our worthy general." Now, calling somebody a worthy general doesn't sound like he was chomping at the bit to kill his captain and under the belief that God would send him directly to heaven for doing so. But in this case, William Graves was right. They were well-manned and well-appointed. Their guns were the best brass guns that money could buy, at least there in Barbary. They had ample stores of powder and shot. They had harquebuses, or harquebi, and they even had a few muskets on board. And they had fine Damascus steel sabers. All of that thanks to their patron, Uthman Day. And all of those armaments would be carried on board four ships by hundreds of sailors. That's a powerful force, especially for pirates. The usual run of galleys and barks and caravels were much more typical for Barbary corsairs, and they could be frightening enough, especially in the right hands, but they weren't a threat to the biggest and best ships on the Mediterranean. A Spanish galleon would chase most pirates off just at the sight of it. Even if they had more ships and more men, the pirates were still more likely to run. But there were yet bigger and better ships out there. The Dutch and Venetians, more than anyone else, had perfected the construction of tall, monstrous ships. They called them argosies. They were still a new invention, though, and mostly they were used for oceanic travel around the world. In particular, the Dutch and the Portuguese used theirs for trade between the East Indies and the Netherlands, while the Venetians used them mostly for trade around the Mediterranean, but they worked well there. They were floating fortresses that were intended specifically to discourage piracy. But they were too big for most harbors at the time. New berths had to be built to accommodate them. Usually, those berths were far from cities, so most people still hadn't seen any of these argosies. One person who was lucky enough to do so remarked that they were, quote, "like a great house of five stories rising from the middle of the sea," end quote. They were massive, in the way that the Titanic was bigger than any ship anyone had ever seen before. These ships were the biggest things sailing. They could carry immense amounts of cargo, as well as 60 to 80 guns. Adrian Tenniswood writes that, quote, "Although they were slow in the water, they were much less vulnerable to attack by corsairs. They were manned by hundreds of sailors and marines, and they towered over the galleys, flyboats, and Burtons favored by most Mediterranean pirates," end quote. But Ward wasn't most Mediterranean pirates. He wanted one of those ships for his own. It would be a coup of massive psychological importance if he could capture one of them. I mean, imagine a pirate sailing into a harbor filled with 400-ton ships, only he was on board an 1,800-ton warship filled with guns, rich cargo, and pirates. What kind of leeway would that give him among his peers? What kind of message would that send to his enemies, both around him and back in Europe? That was Ward's goal, and to that end he sailed for the Gulf of Venice and the Adriatic Sea. On his way, though, between Italy and Eastern Europe, they were hit by a terrible storm. His fleet was scattered, and each of the ships lost sight of one another. Ward, on board Gift, set out to search for his comrades, but he only found Ruby under Anthony Johnson. Ward chose to leave the Adriatic, even before finding Little John or Carminati. He didn't know if they had survived, but if they had, they could make it home on their own, or they could engage in their own sort of mischief. Ward and Johnson set sail for the Aegean Sea in the eastern Mediterranean, between Cyprus and Turkey. While they were on the cruise, they happened across a ship that would make them famous. I wonder, originally Ward set out to find one of those great hulking monsters, those Argo Sea, but he had four ships with him. Now his two most powerful ships were elsewhere, so I wonder, did he hesitate when he saw one of those Argo Sea on 26 April, 1607? Andrew Barker tells us, quote, "He met with a great Argo Sea of 1400 or 1500 tons, very richly laden with Venetian goods, and who, by computation, was esteemed to be worth 2 million at the least," end quote. Now, Ward didn't know how much she was worth yet, but she was a beautiful ship, tall and built of dark wood, carved with glorious reliefs on the stern, towering above the waters and bristling with brass guns. And in the end, that computation may not have been wildly unrealistic. Those big Venetian ships, like this Argo Sea, well, they were usually reserved for the most valuable cargo. These fortresses would carry indigo and spices and sugar, when sugar was still the stuff of king's tables, as well as pepper. They wouldn't be carrying corn or wool, they were carrying extremely valuable cargo. Venice used these only to carry their most valuable treasures. In this case, the Argo Sea was traveling from Turkey back to Venice, carrying all of those things, as well as a wealth of silk and salt, which was perhaps the most valuable cargo on board. And the Argo Sea felt safe. No pirates had ever dared attack one of these ships, at least not and lived to tell about it. It was suicide to try, especially in the little vessels typical for Barbary corsairs. It would take a captain possessed of insane greed and pride to even consider it. Jack Ward ordered his two ships to intercept her. Now, he might not have done so had conditions been different, or he may have been following this Argo Sea for a few days until the weather suited his needs. But on that day, when he did attack, there was only a very light breeze. It left the Venetian giant dead in the water, but Gift and Ruby were able to move and maneuver freely. When the two ships were in range, Jack Ward opened fire. Andrew Barker called the fight that followed, quote, "A merciless and incredible fight, as a man may compare, is between the two tyrants, the remorseless winds and the resisting waters. It was long and it was cruel, it was forcible, and therefore fearful," end quote. The initial engagement lasted for 3 hours. The Argo Sea had 60 guns on board, and they fired off a volley whenever one of Ward's ships sailed into her line of fire. But she was completely unable to maneuver. Ward and Bishop just danced around. Whenever the ship would fire off a volley, they would change their heading so that they presented the smallest amount of possible space to hit. In all 3 hours of firing, the Argo Sea was unable to score a single hit. On the other hand, the ships of Ward were able to pound away at the Argo Sea. Volley after volley slammed against the hull. They might have to change their heading for a minute to miss being hit, but then they could change it back and fire off another volley. The passengers on board the Argo Sea, and there were a lot of passengers on board this vessel, well, they were terrified that anyone would dare attack one of these luxury liners. They all huddled inside, behind stacked-up bales of hay. And then, Captain Ward broke through. The first ball that pierced the hull of the Argo Sea lit one of those hay bales aflame. The passengers huddled behind it ran. The women and children took shelter elsewhere, while the men attempted to fight the blaze with any buckets they could find. They did get it out, now that they were covered in soot and probably burned, and the hay was no longer useful for hiding behind. Ward pierced the hull a total of 5 times, and this little drama played itself out every time. But finally, after 3 hours of a firefight, Ward ordered his men to prepare for a boarding. The captain of the Argo Sea called his officers and his crew and his passengers all together. He asked them whether or not they wished to surrender, or if they preferred to stand and fight. Now, There were more men of fighting age on board the Argo Sea than on both of the combined ships under Captain Ward. However, I still counted a credit, even though they had superior odds, I counted a credit to Venetian bravery that they elected to fight here. They did have the fight in the bag, though. They stood much higher on the water than any of Ward's ships. The pirates would have to use grapples just to reach the deck. They would have to sling hooks into the rigging and the railing, and then they would have to climb the ropes, enduring slings and arrows and harquebus shots. Someone could, while they were being shot at, cut the pirates' ropes, and they definitely would do so given the opportunity, and that means the pirates would fall. Hopefully into the ocean, that means at least they wouldn't break their back hitting the deck. But if they survived the slings and the arrows and the musket balls and the falling to their death and the sharks, they would face a fight at poor odds there at the railing. It was a fool's errand to try and take a ship this large with this many people. Say a dozen pirates sling their grapples onto the deck, and half of them actually make it to deck. That is six pirates, tired, probably hurt, and facing 20, 30, 50 soldiers prepared to kill to defend their ship and their lives. Still, Ward and his two ships closed the gap. The Marines and sailors on board the Argo Sea armed themselves with every gun, every blade, and every axe on board. They stood, clumped up at the rail. The women and the children who were strong enough stood behind the line of defenders armed with bows and arrows, ready to kill any pirate that broke through and helped defend their vessel. Every passenger on board the Argo Sea stood resolute and ready. Then, Ward bellowed off a command. He was waiting until the surf carried his ship down into a dip and then back up. But when it hit the top of its arc, when the moment was just right, when his ship was tipped at just the proper angle for his guns to reach, he opened fire. His cannons were loaded with chain shot. That is, if you're not familiar, two smaller balls connected by a length of chain. In most fights at sea, chain shot was used to tear down rigging, or rip holes in the sails, or, in the best of circumstances, wrap around a mast and tear it down. It could stop a ship in the water by tearing down all of its tackle, and it would leave it vulnerable to boarding. Chain shot was an exceptionally powerful and useful tool. But here, the Argo Sea was already dead in the water. Ward didn't need to take out her rigging, she couldn't move anyway. And the guns on board his ship, even at the top of that arc when the wave carried him up, it still couldn't reach the rigging. But it wasn't intended to. The chain shot that was let fly at the height of the ship's arc in the water tore through the masked defenders standing ready at the rail. When it hit, arms were torn free, necks were broken, skulls were smashed in. At least two men were hit in the torso with a length of chain and torn in half. The rest of the defenders standing at the rail, as well as the women and children standing behind them with bows at the ready, well, they were suddenly covered in blood. Body parts fell onto the deck among them, and alongside the arms and the heads that fell to the deck, the defenders dropped their guns and their sabers and their bows. They ran for the forecastle, for shelter, away from the gore that was exploding on deck. The captain, who had handed them out guns and made sure that the pirates knew he was ready to fight, bellowed at them to get back in place. They had shown their willingness to fight, and they had to do so. However, the carpenter and two gunners supporting him confronted the captain and told him that he was relieved of command effective immediately. Any attempt to continue giving orders, and he would see himself the sudden and violent victim of a mutiny. Parker tells us that the sun shone on Captain Jack Ward that day. Within moments, his men were up over the side, followed by their short, unassuming, bald, foul-mouthed little captain. After the brutally effective use of the chain shot, Jack Ward and his men faced no fight getting on deck. The crew that was left huddled down and surrendered the ship to him immediately. They told Captain Ward that this ship was the Rainiera Isodorina, and it was his. Ward knew that, well, he knew he would be famous after this, but perhaps he didn't know how famous the Reniera y Soderina would make him. The British archives, up until this point, were entirely silent about Jack Ward, minus probably a brief mention about his defection from the Navy that didn't get passed down to history. And then, May 1607. All of a sudden, Jack Ward's name explodes into the British records. They were flooded with furious recriminations of what they now called the arch-pirate Jack Ward. The Venetian ambassador in London went before the Privy Council of King James to tell them that they were perilously close to a war with Venice due entirely to the actions of this pirate, Jack Ward. The English ambassador in Venice went before their governing council to assure them that the English were preparing four men of war to go hunt down Jack Ward in the Mediterranean Sea, as well as an army of agents that would live and work in and around the Barbary Coast, especially in Tunis, Algiers, and Tripoli, to find out anything they could about Ward and his English pirates and hunt him down. He closed by saying that if Jack Ward ever returned from the Mediterranean to the waters around England, he would receive, quote, a very warm welcome. I'd like to thank everyone for listening. And I'd like to leave off today with the rest of that passage that I read at the very beginning of today's episode, from the author of News from the Sea, the passage that glorified his prospective patron. He wrote, "To be a patron, although but to a beggar, is the office of a king, and to be a protector of the meanest, I doubt not, will become the magistrate. It was that which induced me to select you from many of the worthy whose wisdoms, like firm bases, are the upholders of our peace, is not only that your merit stands transparent with the highest, but that you, as it were, self-advancing yourself up the degrees of dignity, you may but, in looking over this little body, be remembered. How ugly vice looks, how deformed she seems without, and how loathsome she is within. So that when the edge of authority shall be put in your hand, you may give this corruption such a blow that her power shall sink like the name of the wicked, not worthy to be remembered, and her sinews be so enfeebled that she shall never renew her strength to have foot again, wherein if I played the bad workman, and that this picture is not drawn out to the life, I beseech you let your countenance be as a curtain to shade it from the contempt of the world. As the painter is studying how to lay the paint, the glory of which shall bring understanding and be of you received as thought worthy of your eyes." End quote. So a special thanks to everyone that has helped support the show. All of our patrons on Patreon, anyone who has donated to the show through the website, everyone who has left us a review on iTunes or Google Play or wherever it is you listen to the show, everyone who has recommended the show to their friends and family on social media or in real life. Without all of you, I wouldn't be able to do this, so thank you. And if I have played the bad workman and this picture is not drawn out, I beseech you, let your countenance be as a curtain to shade it from the contempt of the world. Our theme music was, as always, The Old Captain by the fantastic band Brillig. If you haven't checked them out yet, you really should. They are fantastic. You can find them at brillig.com.au. That's brillig.com.au. After you're done over there, why not check out our website at piratehistorypodcast.com, or you can get in touch on Twitter, SoundCloud, Reddit, or YouTube. As always, and most importantly, thank you for listening. Time has come to
live on in legend tonight.